Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour here on WFMU, Freeform Station of the Nation in Jersey City, in that great state of New Jersey. It's a pleasure to be here with you. Thank you so much for choosing to spend some time listening to this program. And this evening, I've got a great interview for you. We're going to be speaking with Silky Carlo, the director of Big Brother Watch, which is an organization you're going to hear all about in this upcoming interview. Now, often on the show, I talk about the various harms of the surveillance state that is led by several companies in Northern California, collectively known as Big Tech, and their government partners. And increasingly, this partnership between Big Tech and big government is creating a set of conditions that George Orwell could only have dreamed of when he wrote 1984. And that was the book, of course, that introduced us all to Big Brother, this omniscient surveillance force that was watching every move of every citizen and penalizing people who acted wrong, spoke wrong, or even thought wrong. And I think that's the sort of worldview or the sort of thinking that got Big Brother Watch its name. This is an organization based in London, UK, and which is a city, as you will hear, that is bristling with surveillance technologies such as CCTV cameras, closed circuit TV cameras, as well as license plate readers, facial recognition, everything else. And the impetus for putting this show together actually came from a listener recommendation. I am at mark@wfmu.org. I'm always happy to get listener suggestions, ideas for shows. And I got an email from a listener, and in the interest of privacy, I will just say this is listener S, who lives in the UK. And listener S suggested that I bring on Silky Carlo to talk about Big Brother Watch, which is an organization that is trying to do something about this surveillance state, not simply to bemoan the harms and the risks and threats and so on, but actually do something about it, to push back, to fight back for civil liberties. And so thanks to listener S for being instrumental in making this happen. And thanks to Silky Carlo for agreeing to speak. If you'd like to join in the live listener chat during the interview, you can go to WFMU.org and click playlist and comments. If you're interested in seeing the links to the episode or the links within the episode to Big Brother Watch and other things that I may speak about after the interview, go to tectonic.fm, tectonic.fm. And just click the playlist link for the show with Silky Carlo. Let's go ahead and listen now to my interview with Silky Carlo, director of Big Brother Watch, here on Tectonic. Silky Carlo, welcome to Tectonic.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you on the show. You're the director of Big Brother Watch, based in London. Your website says that, quote, "We work to roll back the surveillance state and protect the rights of everyone in the UK to be free from unfair intrusion." What are some tangible examples of the surveillance state that you're trying to roll back at Big Brother Watch?
Well, we have probably one of the most expansive surveillance states in the UK of any democracy in the West, because we have not only the bulk electronic constant mass surveillance architecture that was exposed by Edward Snowden, the NSA whistleblower in 2013. But we've had multiple different technological advances in the growth of the surveillance state in the 10 plus years since. For example, we now have live facial recognition cameras routinely used in the UK by police and also by private retailers. And we even see them creeping into places like schools where kids are paying for their school lunches using facial recognition. But we actually have live facial recognition cameras being used a lot, which of course is now broadly prohibited in across the European Union. And I don't think you see the same in the US at all. And there have been regional bans. We also have the emergence and the growth of AI being used in the criminal justice system, being used by police, whether it's predictive policing, reoffending, scoring. We also have AI in the welfare state. So, for example, if people are claiming disability support, that they are being automatically assessed by algorithms to see if they're how likely it is that they're committing fraud. So, really, across the public sector and the private sector, and that's without even going into the kind of huge corporate surveillance that we live with as well from big tech companies, the UK has become, frankly, completely unrestrained in terms of the growth of the surveillance state. And this is probably an overhang of what we saw in the 90s with the huge growth that we had of CCTV here, which is quite unlike other democracies too. So that kind of trend of mass surveillance has now morphed into high-tech mass surveillance in lots of different ways. And that is why Big Brother Watch's work is very much needed, because we draw attention to it, research, document what's happening, and hold power to account. And we have had some wins, but clearly we are climbing a big mountain here.
Okay, thank you for that. You covered a lot of topics, but I want to start with live facial recognition. I've covered facial rec on the show in the past. I had Kashmira Hill talking about her book on facial rec and an app called Clearview AI. In the UK, I know live facial recognition has become newsworthy recently as the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, in reaction to recent riots, announced the use of live facial recognition. Can you talk about what sets live facial recognition apart from what came before it? And what is the particular danger of live facial rec?
Absolutely. It's a really good question. It's a really important distinction now, and one of about which everyone should be aware. So retrospective facial recognition is the likes of Clearview, as you mentioned, Clearview AI, a company that has scraped as many photos as it can find from the internet and now has 30 billion photos in a database without anyone's permission or consent, and then sells a face search capability to really the highest bidder. I mean, currently it's law enforcement in the US, but it was also being used in the UK until our data protection watchdog tried to fine them £7.5 million and they scuttled off. But all of your listeners are likely to have, tens or potentially hundreds of their own photos sitting in that database without their knowledge or consent, as part of basically a police lineup being searched through all the time. That's retrospective facial recognition. And there is a spectrum of what you can do with retrospective facial recognition. You can have the kind of extreme capability like Clearview AI, where you've got 30 billion photos, or you could have, the equivalent of a normal police lineup with six photos. There were six individuals, or you could have, for example, a police database of people who are known convicts that you can search with facial recognition, which is more proportionate. And then who you search for and how are lots of other questions. But essentially, you could use that as a kind of forensic capability in the same way that a lot of countries have DNA search capabilities and DNA databases. But it's so important if you're a democracy to make sure that that is highly regulated and limited. Then on the other hand, you have live facial recognition, which is completely different. You can have a camera in a highly densely populated place, let's say a train station in central London or New York, where you have millions or tens of millions of people transiting all the time. And the camera can, in real time, perform biometric assessments of everyone's face who walks within view of the camera. So that is like a real-time ID check. And depending on what that camera is referencing, again, that's the same kind of situation you have as with retrospective facial recognition. So that camera could be referencing a police database, or it could be searching visible social media. So there's a huge spectrum of what's possible, but it's so high risk, not only because it reverses the presumption of innocence, it means that everyone who's walking past the camera is suddenly treated like a suspect in real time, walking into a police lineup simply by virtue of being in a public place at any time. And that's one of the really big dangers of it. The second one is that because it's real time, decisions are made very fast. And so something that Big Brother Watch has worked on is where individuals are wrongly stopped because they've been misidentified and then can be stopped in quite aggressive ways by police and interrogated and questioned and threatened with arrest and have more data taken about them. So, you can then enter a situation where people are being wrongly policed. And the other thing that it does is it has a real chilling effect. If you start using live facial recognition cameras at protests, for instance, and demonstrations, or on polling days, or around religious sites, or anything kind of sensitive, then people think twice about going out because people, as it currently stands, are used to being able to go about their lawful business anonymously, or at least without going through a kind of identity parade. And that's the kind of end of the spectrum where you do, it's more reminiscent of what happens in China and Russia, where that expectation of privacy or the expectation of freedom to go about your business as long as you're not doing anything wrong, that's being stripped away technologically by live facial recognition technology.
Yeah, I like what you're bringing up about how the system presumes everyone to be a suspect. This is how I've always felt about surveillance. If the police or whatever law enforcement body or intelligence agency, if they have a bad guy in mind and they want to go conduct some surveillance to look for that bad guy, that's one thing. But when you are drawing down all the private information on all of the citizens, that's a completely different level of surveillance, even the different category of action that I am fundamentally opposed to. And we have, for American listeners, we have quite a bit of surveillance infrastructure built up here. I mean, something as simple as ALPRs, automated license plate readers, which are now installed on the sides of highways throughout the U.S., are capturing the license plate identifiers of everyone as they drive everywhere, which allows the government to track the individual motion of every citizen. And there's no warrant for that. And yet, when I have conversations with some people about this, Silke, what I hear, I'm sure you've heard this as well, is, oh, well, I have nothing to hide. So why should I be worried about surveillance? And by the way, I don't go to all those protests, so I don't mind about that whole chilling effect you're talking about. How do you respond to that, Silke, when you hear that cliched rationalization of surveillance?
Oh, and I hear it all the time. And it's really depressing. Do you know what? I've even spoken to people in the intelligence agencies who say they find it depressing. They wish that people cared about democracy more and that they don't, I mean, some of the better ones don't want that kind of blank check themselves because it is a statement of kind of unconditional surrender to authority, where you're saying, yeah, I have no problem with every inch of my life being recorded and held in a permanent database by the state, just in case I do something that they don't like. That's fine. We've seen already how, even if you've done nothing wrong, you still have something to worry about from mass surveillance. For example, the people who are being misidentified by facial recognition. You have cases in the US where people have been wrongly jailed because of a facial recognition misidentification. Here in the UK, we've had people being pulled down by police officers on the street because they've been misidentified by facial recognition. I watched it happen to a 14-year-old schoolboy who was leapt on by four plainclothed police officers because he had flagged as incorrectly as somebody else on a live facial recognition watch list. These are things that could not happen and would not happen were it not for the technology, because officers put such a high degree of confidence in technology that they make these very quick, extreme decisions on the back of it. We've also seen how, for example, in the US, ALPR cameras are called here in the UK ANPR, automated number plate records. Likewise, our government collects tens of billions of these records every year. It's absolutely phenomenal, the amount of photos that are taken on the roads. And this started in the context of counter-terror operations. It was supposed to be specific and limited and because of an extraordinary threat. But of course, what we all know happens with a surveillance state is if you're not holding it to account, suddenly it becomes used for everyday things. So when we had the coronavirus lockdowns, suddenly police were pulling people over and saying, I see that you've gone from Birmingham to Leicester, say, across different regions of the country. Why have you driven there? Because don't you know? So, and so it becomes used in a way where actually that wasn't even breaking the law, but police were using it for more generalized, loose suspicion-based questioning and enforcement. And then suddenly it affects many, many more people. But the broader point that I would hammer home is, other than the fact that it has a chilling effect, other than the fact you can be wrongly caught up or caught up for very low-level reasons, I think we all have something to worry about if we build the architecture of authoritarian surveillance around a democracy. Because at some point, someone will come into power and use it in a way that you didn't expect. And I have to say, in the US, a lot of people, I'm sure, will be thinking about how a President Trump round two could use that kind of architecture. But it's something we all have to think about everywhere, and not just about who is in positions of power, but what kinds of circumstances we might face that suddenly mean the lever is switched and these powers are used in a way that undermines democracy and harms the public.
You mentioned COVID as an accelerant of the surveillance state, as the government, what's the phrase? They don't want to let a good crisis go to waste.
Yeah.
I think it was Naomi Klein in The Shock Doctrine who wrote about that a crisis allowed governments to put policies in place to expand their power that then became permanent. Here in New York, the memory of 9/11 is still quite vivid, and a number of guests, past guests on this show, journalists or researchers, have told me that 9/11 was that kind of a crisis that really accelerated the growth of the surveillance state in the US. Was that similar in the UK? Did 9/11 have an impact on the surveillance state, the growth of the surveillance state in the UK?
It completely did. Everything changed here in the UK after 9/11. It triggered the huge expansion of CCTV. It triggered, of course, and understandably to some degree, massive change in airport security. But then you see the kind of spillover. So, you get body scanners in different contexts now as well. It triggered the expansion of the road surveillance network that we were just discussing, ANPR. It also led to the massive expansion of the electronic surveillance state, although we only found out about it 12 years later, thanks to Ed Snowden. But of course, that was all triggered literally in the days after 9/11. We know that now from intelligence agency whistleblowers. And even it led to conversations here about things like digital ID cards and a DNA database, which at the time, thankfully, were proposals that were overturned. Sorry, it wasn't digital ID back then. It was a national ID card that was underpinned by a huge state database, which of course, would have digital elements. But nowadays, the conversation is about also the ID being held in a digital form as well. This was an actual physical card. And that was all under the Blair government. What's interesting about this moment right now is, we had about 6, 7, 8 years of these huge civil liberties debates post 9/11 under the Labour government, under Tony Blair. And just a few weeks ago, we've had our first Labour government since. And Tony Blair is still in a really powerful position in British politics and advises the Labour Party very closely and has already been in the newspaper saying we need to have digital IDs. We need to have more facial recognition. We need to have all these kinds of surveillance elements that he's so known for championing. And by the way, he takes money from some companies that might benefit from some of these suggestions. So I think that we are potentially on the brink of a new wave of some of these huge debates, although, you know, unfortunately, the debates aren't of the quality that they were back then. I mean, I'm sure you remember, Mark, the debates you had in the US, for example, about body scanners in, you know, the noughties. It's kind of hard to imagine now, isn't it, having the same quality of debate because people have been so desensitized to intrusion.
Totally true. I remember when Google came out with Gmail, and for a couple of years, everybody was excited that there was this free email service that wasn't terrible, like Hotmail. And then the revelation came out that Google had algorithms that were reading the contents of people's emails so it could target ads, and people went bananas. What, and by the way, Google claims they no longer do this, but at the time, people were outraged that Google unilaterally would have algorithms reading their private messages in order to feed into their ad system. Those were such innocent days, Silky. I mean, it's like 1,000 times worse than that now. And every big tech platform, every feature is just larded down with intrusive surveillance, and people say almost nothing about it.
I know. It's tough. And that's part of the job of you know, group like Big Brother Watch, is our job is to keep that conversation alive and also to reinvigorate it. And there are areas where I think we are having success. And I also think that the other thing we could be on the brink of is the so-called tech lash, and that more and more people are getting uncomfortable with the state of affairs. And even if they're not framing it as we are, perhaps from, you know, our perspectives of maybe having thought about this for a longer time, people are uncomfortable with social media platforms and the algorithms that kind of keep their kids addicted to phones and devices. And people are wanting to switch off more. People are getting a bit more suspicious about the tech that is integrated into our lives. And I think there might be a way of trying to turn that into a kind of a message for freedom and a pause for thought about what kind of future are we creating. We have been very complacent. We have assumed that because we live in democracies in the US and the UK, that we can kind of adopt the technology of totalitarian states and yet still be fine. But let's pause and think about what the risks are. And on the brink of an AI revolution and in the midst of the technological revolution that we're living in, what kind of future do we actually want for the human future? We talk about technology all the time. We don't really talk about humanity. What do we want from our human future?
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are halfway through my interview with Silky Carlo, director of London, UK-based Big Brother Watch. As you can hear, Big Brother Watch is fighting back against the surveillance state, which is built and maintained and is growing on behalf of the UK government with the use of many different types of surveillance technology. And as Silky said, some people are beginning to show some skepticism around technology, such as surveillance and big tech platforms and AI. And that's good news. So we're getting a little bit of hope. Let's go ahead and listen to the second half of my interview now with Silky Carlo here on Tectonic. Let me set up a scenario and ask how Big Brother Watch would take this on, or maybe you've taken something like this on already in the UK. But just speaking from my own local experience, I live in Manhattan, and anytime you walk down one of the major avenues in Manhattan, you're walking past these 9-foot-tall kiosks that have computer screens on either side, and they have these silly little messages and advertising that play on the screens. But what a lot of people don't realize is that there are hidden cameras on either side of the kiosk, on top of the computer monitor on both sides. What people also do not know, these things are called Link NYC. They don't know the company that's behind the kiosks. The company behind the kiosks is Google. So Google is taking down video, and there are Wi-Fi sniffers and all sorts of other sensors in these kiosks on every New York citizen that walks up and down these major avenues. They're getting all this data for free. There has never been, to my knowledge, any public debate about the privacy risks of one of the world's largest and most powerful companies working hand in hand with law enforcement to share private data from these intrusive surveillance devices that now blanket the city. No one's talking about it. And there have been some efforts here, but really my question, Silke, is what would Big Brother Watch do in this case? Or do you have an experience from London in which you've taken something like this on, and what did you do?
Well, it sounds like we need a Big Brother Watch US because there absolutely does need to be scrutiny and a kind of expose of that kind of technology. It's extraordinary. Maybe it's a job for the EFF or, the groups that are there. But yes, we have had similar. We released a report in 2022 called The Streets Are Watching, which is about exactly this kind of thing. It's about how what the companies call street architecture, street furniture, like digital billboards, about, actually that they are collecting data. And that could be Wi-Fi sniffers, as you say. There are cameras. I think it sounds much more intrusive in the US. What we've seen in the UK, it tends to be aggregated data. So, for example, if a billboard works out that mostly at 3 o'clock on a Friday, it's 30 to 45 year old mums walking past the billboard, then they target the ads. There have been some all kinds of different examples. I mean, sometimes they've tried to kind of gamify this kind of surveillance advertising as well. So there have been examples of billboards where that you can interact with, that you can like smile at, and then there's an emoji that comes out that's kind of smiling back at you. And of course, when they're doing that, they're collecting demographic information as well about the individuals. There is a risk, and this is why it's so important that, we undertake research like that, and that with what you found, that there is journalism and coverage of when this happens, because if you don't, the risk is that it becomes individualized and connects with, if you've got Wi-Fi sniffing, does it connect then with what you're doing at home, what you're doing on other devices? And that can be really intrusive.
Yeah, I assume that whatever Google is drawing down on people goes into the dossier that they have on you from everything else in their sprawling surveillance platform. So, yeah, I think that's happening. So, for a Big Brother Watch US, let's say, if there was such a thing, write a report and get publicity for it. Is Big Brother Watch also taking legal action of some sort in some of your cases?
Yeah, so we have five different ways that we work. Research and investigations is a big aspect of what we do. Public education, and we do a lot in the press and kind of disseminating our materials across other civil society groups, our networks, and importantly with policymakers, which brings me on to the third thing, which is parliamentary lobbying. So, we try when we develop research, we try not to just kind of sit on it or just share it among friends, but we take it to the heart of power. Our office is a 10-minute walk from Parliament, and we will take our reports into Parliament and hold meetings and generate a debate around what we found and push for certain policy changes. And the other thing that we do is public campaigning. So we will try to mobilize the public around some of our campaigns as well to get change that way. And then if we really have to, we do strategic litigation. Or different types of legal action. We have a data privacy watchdog, if you like, called the Information Commissioner. And so, for example, about surveillance advertising, if we find something that we think is a breach of data protection rules, we will put in a formal complaint. But sometimes we take much bigger strategic legal action. And we did that in a landmark case against the UK government in a case known as Big Brother Watch versus the UK, which was about the Snowden revelations. That went all the way through the courts, right up to the Grand Chamber of the European Court of Human Rights, the highest human rights court in Europe. And we won. We won in terms of challenging the bulk interception that was uncovered by Snowden in the Tempora program. Our signals intelligence agency, GCHQ, essentially kept a buffer of what people were doing on the internet and kept records of what people were doing that aimed to keep a web browsing profile of every visible user of the internet, including British citizens and people internationally, which of course is not what anyone expected. Parliament had no idea about this, let alone the general public. There was no democratic authorization for it at all. But how the government responded was then to introduce a new law so that it was more explicit. And in the current culture in which we live, unfortunately, that was passed and that had backing from Parliament. But we're currently, there's ongoing legal action around mass interception and bulk surveillance. We also are currently bringing a legal challenge against the Metropolitan Police in London for their use of live facial recognition technology. We've got a few other examples of legal action up our sleeve when it comes to facial recognition and other uses, secretive uses of algorithms by different areas of the public sector.
Well, it sounds like you have your hands full.
I do. Yeah. And we're a really small team. It's amazing what you can do with a small team of really highly motivated people who know their stuff. We're just seven full-time staff.
Well. Wow.
That's it. And we run on a shoestring. But the important thing is we all massively care about what we do. And we have made a difference. We've won cases. We have got massive state databases deleted. We've got AI programs in being run by police overturned. We've changed policies and laws. So, it's easy sometimes if you're a campaigner on privacy and surveillance in this period of time, it's easy to feel despondent and like the kind of tide is you're just really swimming against the tide. But we take every inch of support that we get from the public as far as we can run with it. And we have had some really great successes as a result.
I want to talk about one of your campaigns in particular. This one is listed on your website. This is about digital currencies. The Big Brother Watch website has announced a No Spy Coin campaign, which says that, quote, "The government's plan to pilot a central bank digital currency by 2025 would threaten privacy like never before." What are the risks of digital currencies managed by central banks? Because this is going to be happening everywhere pretty soon.
Absolutely. There are, I think, over 100 nations that are piloting or planning now the use of a central bank digital currency. So a currency centrally issued, but in the digital form. There are a number of risks. I mean, the first issue that comes up in a lot of jurisdictions, as it has done in the UK, is the why question. And that's certainly the question that came up in the UK when Parliament first looked at the government's case being made for a CBDC. MPs said, but we don't know why we need one. And given that it creates such a risk, a new piece of critical national infrastructure that's digitized and that invokes lots of financial and digital risks, there has to be a really good case for it. Why do we need that? And no one's really been able to ask that question. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that, of course, a state-run database essentially of people's money opens up a whole new spectrum for privacy intrusion. And well, there is already privacy intrusion when it comes to money. Most of us hold money with private banks, retail banks, or we have digital payment providers like PayPal, et cetera, who don't have a perfect track record on privacy. And also, there are increasingly, again, talking about the post 9/11 context, sweeping laws like counter-terror financing and anti-money laundering that means to some degree there is ongoing constant surveillance over financial transactions. But to have a state-operated database where the currency is held by the state in a digital form does open up the prospects for a huge amount more in terms of intrusion by the state. It's so much more direct. And the other thing that that comes with is that you have to have the digital currency linked to an identifier. And so a lot of CBDC plans are going hand in hand with digital ID. Then you have a digital ID that links to your bank account or your CBDC bank account. And then we've got the digital ID question. And the digital ID question opens up huge can of worms in terms of privacy risks, who gets one, who can't get one. Will there be kind of identity paywalls that mean that some people can use this currency and some people can't? We also have a lot of people that don't have ID. There's still a lot of people in the UK, particularly poor people, who don't actually own a passport. So there are some issues there. And the other thing, a really big question around a CBDC is this question of programmability, that if you have a digital currency, that you can digitally control the expression of that money, how it's used and what it's used for. And that really excites some people with power. In simple terms, it can mean things like you can digitally alter the currency according to changing interest rates. So rather than the money just being worth more or less, the money itself actually changes according to interest rates. It means that you can have money that expires, and it means that you can have money that can only be used for certain things. And so, for example, there are people on the right of politics who say, you know, they get really excited about that because they say, well, if somebody's in receipt of benefits, then we can make sure that they're not spending the money on alcohol and cigarettes, or frivolous things. We can make sure they're just spending it on, you know, vegetables or bread. And so it lends itself to a lot of control and authoritarianism. And of course, I mean, again, looking back to how some of digital systems were repurposed for control during COVID, if you look at how payment providers like PayPal cut people off for being kind of COVID dissidents, or, you know, the Canadian banks that froze people's accounts for supporting the Canadian trucker protest, for example. I mean, going right back, Julian Assange's PayPal accounts being frozen. There is a rich history of examples there about how digital payment platforms can also be used for control. And that's a really important thing, because the money that you have in a society is to some degree the power that you have in a society. And if you have an immediate block access on that and control access on that by the state, you can guarantee that it will be used.
Yeah, I'm just imagining how this all connects with technologies like the live facial recognition you mentioned before. Someone wants to get on a train or a bus or a plane or something, and they're identified, or maybe they're misidentified as someone who has said something or associated with someone, who knows, had some action in their private life that the government doesn't like. And then not only are they barred from getting on that train, when they get home, they find that they can't even access their bank account. I mean, the pieces are in place for something like that.
They're exactly. And then we're just kind of operating on trust that it won't happen to us. But like I always say, the blueprint is China. And I don't mean that at all to say that we have to assume that using similar technological systems must equal the same outcomes. Of course, it doesn't mean that, but it means that it's possible. And it means that we're also seeing examples of where technology has been integrated into societies already to be used in that way. I mean, I think the example that you give is one that does already apply in China, where there are facial recognition payment systems and in some areas, social credit, where, you know, essentially people don't have rights, they have privileges that are determined by their behavioral records and then administered through essentially digital ID and facial recognition. And this is a very, China is a very extreme end of the spectrum. But again, look at what happens with a journalist, a publisher like Julian Assange. Look at what happens with the protesters in Canada. I'm not saying anyone needs to agree with either of those people to at least appreciate the risks that even a democratic state, in the interest of protecting its own power, might sometimes use those levers of control in ways that people didn't necessarily expect when they were introduced.
Yeah, totally agree. That Canadian trucker protests was really scary. I mean, again, as you're saying, totally independent of whatever their politics are, you have a group of people protesting a government decision, and their financial assets are all frozen by the government. A very top-down decision by a government that wants to protect its power. And maybe listeners say, well, I really didn't like those truckers. I disagreed with their political leanings, and fair enough. But then you have to ask yourself, what happens when the government changes and now it's your side of the political spectrum that's being targeted with those same technologies?
Exactly. This is something, I mean, even that way of thinking is something that has been lost in moderate and left politics over recent years. And that really concerns me, because it used to be that in left politics in particular, there was a very strong tradition of using rights to protect your opponents and using rights to protect your enemies, because we all realize that ultimately, those rights are going to work in our interest, and the arc of history is going to bend towards justice. So, if we have the right to free speech, we can campaign for civil rights, we can campaign for gay rights, we can campaign for progressive changes in society. And again, there's a level of complacency where we've won enough battles that now we think the censorship shoe is on the other foot. But actually, we really need those rights. And I think something that we should all do more is be a bit agnostic to the causes that we apply them to. Like, privacy and freedom of expression, free speech, freedom of association, the civil liberties that we have, the right to protest, they matter for our opponents, potentially even more than they matter for ourselves, because it's also a way of winning the argument about rights. When anti-democratic people realize that the right to protest and the right to free speech and privacy actually serves them, they become champions of it too. So it's essential for a democracy. And I think you've got groups like, the American Civil Liberties Union in the US, and Liberty in the UK, and Big Brother Watch in the past couple of decades, that we try to use and exercise rights in precisely that way.
I'm sorry to say, Silke, that we're just about at time, but where can Tectonic listeners go to get involved and learn more about what you're doing at Big Brother Watch?
We are bigbrotherwatch.org.uk. We're at Big Brother Watch on Twitter or X, and Big Brother Watch HQ on YouTube. We're on Instagram somewhere, and the other social media platforms. And yeah, I would love people to, in particular, sign up to our newsletter, because that's where you'll get up-to-date information and campaign news about what's happening kind of week to week in the UK.
Yeah, email is great because that's communication from you to the readers without going through a mercurial billionaire-owned toxic sludge factory in Northern California. But I digress.
Yeah, that's the best way to keep in touch with us. And yeah, we're writing those emails ourselves, and obviously, and telling people what's going on. So that's always the place that we put the news first too.
Silke Carlo, thanks so much for being on the show, and I hope you'll be back with us again sometime.
I really appreciate it. It's been great chatting. Thank you.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the last little bit of the show. I want to say thanks to Silke Carlo, director of Big Brother Watch, for joining us and describing why privacy is important in a democracy. Why it's harmful to build a surveillance state with an asymmetry of power with a government and incredibly powerful corporations always watching and listening to citizens in their daily lives, turning everybody into a suspect with things like live facial recognition, and potentially instrumenting that to squelch freedom of speech and any kind of dissent. And I hope you paid attention to that example of the Canadian trucker protests. I don't know if I spoke about this on the show when it occurred, but as I said in the interview, a lot of people here in the U.S., I am afraid, saw that and said, well, I don't really agree with their politics, so I guess that's just what happens. They got their comeuppance. The government used its surveillance powers and shut them down. And I really don't think that's the right response. As Silky said, we have to be, if you happen to find yourself on an opposite side of the political spectrum as the Canadian truckers, maybe you're not, but if you are on a different political leaning, you have to look for ways to take care of your opponents even more, because we do not want to set up a situation where the government is just going to use surveillance powers to turn off anyone it disagrees with. You may agree with the government today, but what happens in the next election? And of course, here we are in election season here in the U.S. So thanks to Silky Carlo for being with us. As I mentioned earlier, there's a playlist that has links to Big Brother Watch and some other resources. You can find this playlist at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. Find the Silky Carlo interview. And there's a link on the playlist to Big Brother Watch's 2022 report that Silky mentioned, called The Streets Are Watching, How Billboards Are Spying on You. And it talks about how many digital billboards in the UK, and I'm sure it's going to be spreading here in the US if it's not already here, many digital billboards are now equipped with high-definition cameras that can monitor the public space in front of them. Some of these cameras go beyond simple video recording and can detect and analyze somebody's face, their characteristics, what they're wearing, purely for your convenience, you understand, so that you can get relevant ads. That's the only possible reason that corporations and the government would be interested in cameras mounted street side to watch every citizen as they walk past. Now here, BBW is talking about digital billboards. As I told Silky, if you walk up 5th Avenue, 6th Avenue, 7th Avenue, 8th Avenue in Manhattan, you're going to walk past the Google surveillance kiosks. They're not called that. They're called Link NYC, and they claim to be from a separate company called Intersection. But no, it's Google. It's Google / Alphabet with cameras that are watching you as you walk past, and monitoring you in various ways. So the surveillance state is being built here in the U.S. too. So I hope you can see how what Silky is talking about in the U.K. is completely applicable to our experience as Americans. And if you are outside the U.S., which, by the way, you're very welcome here at Tectonic, in whatever country you live, there is surveillance. I guarantee there is surveillance technology that is growing and proliferating and spreading all around you, and it is increasing the asymmetry of power between the government and big tech companies and you and your family and your community. And that's why it's so important that we figure out a way to fight back. So good on Silky Carlo and her 7-person team that is making a difference. And I wish them all the best. I want to say something about what's happening here at WFMU. You may have heard, if you've been listening the last few days, in the month of October, we do this small October fundraiser called the Heck Raiser, in which we have a couple of new T-shirts, and it's a way for us to pay the bills at the end of the year. You might notice, if you've just started to listen to WFMU, you didn't hear any ads during this show. There's no underwriting breaks. This is not an NPR station. We're not taking money from Bill Gates like NPR. You can listen to last week's show about that. We rely on you, the listeners. So this is just a quick reminder. Please go to WFMU.org and pitch in some money so that we can pay our bills for the rest of the year. If you do it right now, you can click the box that you want to indicate Tectonic as a favorite show. But really, that's not the important thing. The important thing is that you support the station. If you give $50, you can get one of the two new T-shirts. There's a Golden Airwaves T-shirt, and there's an Anglerfish T-shirt, which, by the way, there was an Anglerfish T-shirt for Tectonic a couple of years ago. This one's different. It's also very attractive. There are four Anglerfish, one for each of the letters, WFMU. If you pitch in $100, you can get both T-shirts, and that's what I'm planning on doing because I like the T-shirts here. And that's the pitch. I hope you will pitch in and show your support for this. Great radio station. In the couple of minutes I have left before I fire up our old outro song for this evening, I want to say that there are a number of surveillance-related news stories coming out every single day. I can just very quickly list a couple of them. One is from Wired. This is October 3rd, 2024. The headline is, "License Plate Readers Are Creating a U.S.-Wide Database of Political Lawn Signs and Bumper Stickers." So we've talked about ALPRs, Automated License Plate Readers, that are everywhere in the U.S. If you drive a car, your license plate is being scanned multiple times a trip. If you go anywhere on any major roadway or highway, it's being scanned, and that data that is associated with you, your name, your address, that data of you being at that checkpoint is being fed to law enforcement and intelligence agencies, and being used in all sorts of ways. And we've known that for years. You can go back years ago and listen to my interview with John Fasman, where I believe the book is called We See It All, and we talked about ALPRs, and this is years ago. But what's new now that Wired is reporting on ALPRs is that the ALPRs are now not only capturing the license plate, they're capturing the full side of the car that they're facing. And any data that can be picked up, I'm sure there are AI-enabled algorithms that allow them to detect whatever is in that image, and that includes bumper stickers. And a lot of people have bumper stickers showing their political leanings. And again, as far as this goes, it doesn't matter if you're on the left, if you're on the right. If you're for this candidate, you're for that candidate, you are being spied on by the government. And let me just say once again, this fight that we should all unite and unite together and join this fight against surveillance, this fight is not left versus right. No, it's about big tech and their government partners versus all the rest of us, left and right together. So whatever bumper sticker you may have on your car is being read by those ALPRs and being fed into a government database that covers everybody across the U.S. That is not a healthy situation. And there is there's something else about smartwatches and assassinations. I'm out of time, but let me just say, take your smartwatch. This is my suggestion. Take your smartwatch, go to the nearest body of water, and just chuck it as far as you can into that water. And go get yourself an unwired Casio G-Shock or any kind of wristwatch that does not have a communication chip in it that's going to feed your information back to big tech. And I mean that throwing it in the river metaphorically, of course. Take it to an e-waste disposal like a good human being. I have some homework for you for next time, friends. I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. You're listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County, 90.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Please stay tuned for Dave Mandel, who's not a vandal. He's got a great show called It's Complicated. It's a prog rock show. For our outro, I want to hear a song by highly effective people. It's called Under Surveillance. Have a great week, everybody.
Under surveillance.
Welcome to another exciting installment of It's Complicated. This show comes to you every Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. Thrilled always to be here playing music for you. Thanks for joining me. And we're going to jump in to tonight's show, on tonight's show, with music from a Moody Blues spinoff. A little while back, a few months ago, was it? Time flies when you're having fun. Mike Pinder died, who was the keyboard player and mellotron player from the Moody Blues. He died a few months ago, and I played a song of his in tribute from his solo album, I think. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm going to play now a track from another one of the Moody Blues solo albums. So in the mid-70s, 75, I'm going to say, 1975, the Moody Blues, like so many other groups, massive ego-driven bands, decided they were all the members of the band were going to make their own solo albums. Who did it? Well, Kiss did it. Yes did it. Pink Floyd sort of did it. And the Moody Blues did it. So I'm going to play a track from the album that two members of the Moody Blues collaborated on, namely Justin Hayward and John Lodge. Justin Hayward was the guitarist in the Moody Blues, very distinctive, lovely, fuzzy guitar sound, and John Lodge was the bass player. Justin Hayward sang not all, but a lot of the Moody Blues songs. Really lovely voice, as you will hear in a minute. So we're going to hear a track from the album that they collaborated on, which was called Blue Jays in 1975. And it sounds, it almost is, and sounds just like a Moody Blues record. It was produced by the Moody Blues producer, a guy named Tony Clark, and features, I believe, Mike Pinder on Mellotron, that really distinctive Moody's sound. So this is a really beautiful song, in my opinion, IMHO. This is a nice one. It's a track called This Morning, from Justin Hayward and John Lodge.
As the dawn is breaking on your future, my child, is the love your love alive? If every door you open closes on me, I don't know if I can survive. I don't know if I can survive. Something was wrong. Turning, I realized I wanted to cry, but I knew I was alone. But where will you go, and who will be your guide, and which way will you turn? The water lies so wide that the sun is rising on your freedom, my child. Is the blood of your love alive? Every door you open closes on me. I don't know if I can survive, knowing part of your love was lying. Long is the road that takes you. On the hour and lonely is the night, poor tormented soul searching for the light. The moment I opened my eyes, I knew from the silence that something was